shoo-wop, shoo-wop, ooh. Ooh, shoo-wop, shoo-wop, ooh.
Welcome to the Kindness Collective podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Harrington, where each week I'll be interviewing game changers who are up to good things in the world, supporting us with health and wellness resources, and ultimately how to live your kindest life. Let's get started. Hello, everybody. Patrick Harrington here, the Kindness Collective podcast. I'm here with Mr. Jarrell Jones. Thanks so much for being here, brother.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Oh, if you could see the smile, the podcast would be complete if we could just get you to see his smile right now. One of my favorite human beings, somebody that always teaches me something and helps me to remember things about myself. Yeah, just a man, a father, a community member, a person who has served his country in the military, yoga teacher, so many things, and don't even want to box him in with any of those labels. Just really a man on the planet, and all of that comes out of, you know, the growth and the experience that has brought him to this point. And so feel really, really happy to dive in a little bit deeper on some of the subjects that him and I have talked about. Let's see. I think let's just start with where are you from and how did it all begin?
I like to say I'm originally from planet Earth.
Yeah.
Everywhere I travel becomes a part of me, so I don't consider myself from any one place. Mm. But this body came into form in Orlando, Florida.
Okay. Okay. What year was that?
1982.
1982. Okay. Young Patrick was just 10 years old at that point. Uh-huh. and so you took some time to get to Colorado. When did you come to Colorado?
I arrived in Colorado April 2009.
Okay. And what brought you here?
I lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico before moving to Colorado, but my first intro into Colorado was snowboarding in Wolf Creek and enjoying the hot springs in Pagosa.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. That's a great entrance.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, for those of you that don't know, Wolf Creek, they're famous for, you know, having neck-deep powder.
Yes.
It was amazing. So did you spend some time up living in the mountains then up there?
No, not at all. I was still living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then the drive was about 2.5-3 hours from there.
Okay.
And I would take trips there pretty occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty often.
Yeah, I lived down in that area too. I was in Durango. That was the first place I went to school, but that was 96. No, I graduated in 91-ish. Beautiful part of the country. I could see how someone getting introduced to Colorado right there could fall in love.
Right.
Did you fall in love with Colorado? Is that what brought you here?
It's more like Colorado I saw as an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came here, I originally moved here for the snowboarding. But then when the seasons changed and we entered summer, then I discovered hiking and camping, and then the fall hit, and then the leaves started to change, which was some beautiful contrast. And just all of the seasons is what really brought me here, which landed in my heart to be the longest place that I've lived since I was a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, because Orlando doesn't have 4 full seasons.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's just strip malls and flat land and things as such.
Shout out to Orlando. yeah, no. And so you were in Albuquerque, you transitioned over to Wolf Creek down now and again. And then when did you come into the Denver area?
Came into the Denver area in 2009.
Okay.
I was still working overseas. So Colorado was kind of like, I would work on a three month overseas and then 1 month back here in the States. So Colorado became like my vacation spot when I wasn't somewhere else around the world.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. And so Talk a little bit about how you got into working overseas.
I did military police special reaction team, which is the equivalent to civilian SWAT. Mm-hmm. And after completing my 4-year contract in the Marine Corps, I tried out for a couple of different overseas contractors and ended up finding a place with a company that sent me back over to Ramadi, Iraq.
Mm.
And then how did I get into that? I found that what I was exposed to in the military was very disciplined. I knew what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with being deployed overseas. We knew exactly what we were working with. And I found that coming back into civilian life after being exposed to what I was, that it was a little bit more, not so easy for me to integrate into the community.
Yeah.
So I found out about some high threat security jobs and decided that that was my passion because I enjoyed working out and shooting and training. That was my passion, that I had the opportunity to go back overseas and I jumped right on it.
Right. And so would you be in the capacity of protecting somebody those situations?
Yes. I worked for the Department of State High Threat Security.
Uh-huh. Wow, I didn't even know that we had a department like that. You don't hear about that much.
It's a pretty small department.
Yeah.
So what it is, they have security details for all of our U.S. diplomats and I'd say high threat areas.
Yeah.
So like Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So we fall underneath the U.S. Embassy, and the U.S. Embassy has its consulate spread throughout different countries, and they hire private security to do protection for the U.S. diplomats as they push U.S. foreign policy around different areas and such.
Sure. Yeah, totally makes sense. Were the people you were working with in that, would you call it a unit or that group, that detail?
So the people that I was working with were all ex-Army Rangers and Navy SEALs and different special forces all together.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that we would protect, like sometimes we did security details for like Hillary Clinton and all of our U.S. U.S. senators that would visit a foreign place wherever we were at that time.
Right.
And there were different locations, like a couple of different places in Afghanistan, a couple of different places in Iraq, but there's different little outposts that you can rotate around to. Well, different U.S. consulates that you can rotate around to.
What was it like living conditions wise? Where would you stay? Talk a little bit about what that would look like in that role.
I would say it's kind of different everywhere you go because it depends on the U.S. footprint in the area that you're at.
Hmm.
In Pakistan, we had a small compound and all the guys stayed in one big house and there were probably about 30 guys.
Hmm.
And we all lived together and had it set up to where we could protect our establishment, I guess you could say.
Sure.
I haven't went back into this storyline in a while, so I'm kind of regurgitating it from back then.
Yeah. And so that was 2000, that was pre-2009 or that was post?
That was post. So I finished working overseas in 2013.
Okay.
And the last place that I worked at was Super Fob in Afghanistan.
Super Fob?
Yes.
Huh. That's an interesting name. Is that means something else?
It's just a name in their language. For a forward operating base.
Uh-huh. And that was just the end of your latest contract? Or you said, no. I'm going to be done at that time?
So the way that we started running our security missions didn't feel right to me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have a place to stay on the base. And as we were leaving to go on a mission back to Super Fob, we were at another base that was about an hour away. And on the way back, one of our vehicles broke down, so we left the vehicle and decided to do a one-vehicle motorcade. At least that's what we were ordered to do.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way back, well, before we even left, it didn't feel right because you always got to have a backup just in case one drops down. If not,
sure, you're stuck. Yeah,
and you're out in Indian country, Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way back, there's an insurgent crossing the road with four RPGs and a couple AKs. And he started lighting us up with the AKs, and we were in one vehicle as we were pushing through, and I was driving. And we made it through that. Lucky the guy wasn't smart enough to pull the RPG off his back and fire it at us. It was just, we were in an up-armored vehicle, so the rounds weren't penetrating anything, so it's fine. But at that moment when we made it back to base, I was like, I'm done. and it was just, it felt stupid to me to put my life on the line.
Yeah.
From any point past then.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, and that was the end of contracting for me.
Right. And so at that point, were you able to say,
oh, yes,
I quit, I walk?
Yeah, so as a civilian, you have contracts that you can sign up for.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, at any point that it's not comfortable with you, you can just step out of the contract.
Hmm. Great. Wow. And so let's reverse time a little bit. You spent 4 years in the Marine Corps.
Yes, 4 years in the Marine Corps.
And so at what age did you go into the Marine Corps?
I went into the Marine Corps at the age of 18 and turned 19 in boot camp.
Okay. And talk to me about the moment that you signed the recruiting form. Maybe you were walking towards the recruiting desk or towards the, you know, just describe the scene, describe Jarrell's state of mind, state emotion.
I came from a home that wasn't, I guess, your normal setting.
Mm-hmm.
And I dropped out of high school in 11th grade because it wasn't for me. Then I started trying to, I went to like a fast track.
Yeah, like a GED place, kind of.
First, it was like an accelerated high school program.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, I just don't have a desire to do this either. And then I found out that I could test for my GED and got my GED and was going to start working. And then I found myself still running in the same circles, and there was a calling for me to do something else.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed playing football. I played football at an early age, and I enjoyed the tactics of being a middle linebacker and taking somebody out. So yeah. The combativeness really set well in my heart when it came to choosing like which military to go into, meaning which branch to go into.
I want to ask a quick clarifying question. You said it felt good in my heart,
right?
I want to challenge that. I wonder, did taking somebody out feel good in your heart or in your head at that time?
Actually, in my head at that time, 100%.
Okay.
Because I was a really heady person. I was not in my heart whatsoever.
But yeah, it sounded like Jarrell sitting here now answered the question for the high school kid.
Exactly.
But my guess is that it was more of a head thought.
It was a head thought.
Yeah.
So when it came to looking at the different branches, the Marine Corps was supposed to be the toughest.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do
the
most challenging branch of the military.
Were you the first person in your family to be in the military?
My grandfather was in the Army back in, I'm not sure exactly. He was there after the Battle of Okinawa, like right on the tail end of it.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Was he an influence in your life?
Yes, he was. But he didn't talk about the military at all. He just showed up with a certain presence.
Mm-hmm. Well, how would you describe that presence?
Very calm. Kind of the eyes, his eyes wide open on the horizon.
Mm.
Did simple things like farmed his own food, like grew his own collard greens and vegetables as such.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoyed fishing a lot.
Yeah.
We just had a very calm presence about him. Very calm, loving presence.
Wow. Would you say that who were some of your heroes? Is he a part of?
I don't necessarily have heroes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mentors or people that, did he influence you?
Subconsciously, yes.
Mm-hmm.
directly. Did he
mentor you? Yeah.
Yeah, not necessarily, so no.
Hmm. Okay, so you decided to go for the most challenging one. So you're walking up to the place. Where was the recruiter at that time?
So at the time, I was living in... I had talked to the recruiting station in Kissimmee, Florida, and they said that the Marine Corps for the state of Florida only accepts 2 GED graduates a year. And at that time, my parents had divorced and my mom moved to Maryland, so I was playing 2 recruiting stations at the same time mm-hmm. to get the first GED spot that was available.
Oh, nice.
So I could kind of have both residences and go from either or. So at that time, I was living in Rockville, Maryland, and got a call from the recruiter in Florida that a spot had became available. And I waited about 4 months to go into the Marine Corps.
Hmm. And so when you got that phone call, what happened in your body? Do you remember? Was it just like...
It was kind of like a subtle shift. There was not much...
Yeah.
It's just moving in a certain direction.
Yeah. Cool. And so where did you go and do boot camp?
Beaufort, South Carolina.
Beaufort, South Carolina.
Paris Island. Beaufort, South Carolina, yes.
So it's an actual island?
Yes. Well, it's not... it is an actual island because there's a bridge uh-huh. for you to get to. It's like on an intercoastal waterway, I guess you
uh-huh.
could say.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And how did that experience galvanize or change you?
Changed me in very many ways. When graduating boot camp, I felt like I became a part of something.
Mm.
I feel like while I was in boot camp, they broke down everything that I thought I might have been and built me back up to what I could become for the Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
which is a mean green killing machine, I guess right. you could say.
Yeah.
So it's like I went into boot camp, they broke down everything, and then they reprogrammed me.
Yeah.
And how did I feel about that? I felt unstoppable. Mm-hmm. I felt like I could get hit by a car and the car would yeah. break apart.
Right.
I felt immortal.
Mm.
Yes.
And you had a team. You had crew.
A team of about 290,000 at the time I was in. That's the way I felt about it.
Wow.
Yeah.
What from pre-Jarrell do you feel like was lost that you might at this point in your life wish was back or wish that hadn't gotten programmed out or deconstructed during that experience?
Well, that question came up a lot for myself actually. And in the beginning, when I came back from war with all of the different ways of being open to how the world really is or how it was through my lenses, I wanted to go back to being oblivious
mm-hmm.
to getting a job and working the blue collar job and just being focused within the system that was here in the United States. But once being opened up or once my eyes were open,
exposed,
yeah. that's mm-hmm. the word I was looking for. Once my eyes were exposed, there was no going back because it just created I don't know the word exactly.
Yeah, you can't unsee.
Right.
I imagine all of the things from the violence to the, you know, the unexpected to just the way that the world works outside yeah, of, you
exactly.
know, your suburban, you know, upbringing.
100%.
Yeah, I imagine it's life-blowing, mind-blowing for anybody to leave the country and to get to see things. But then I think one of the parts about being of service in a institutional format, meaning Marine, military service or police officers,
right.
is what I notice is that I'm always aware of where they are in the room. If there's a police officer somewhere, if there's a man in military fatigues,
yes.
I am conscious of them. And so is everybody else, to a greater or lesser degree, I'm sure of it. And so something that I always have a lot of compassion for is that I don't know how much of the training prepares someone to be the center of attention. During police training, are you being made aware of how to deal with the fact that everyone is looking at you sideways wherever you are?
Right.
Same thing with the military. Now, if you're in another country and you're wearing American fatigues, you're carrying a weapon, I can imagine it might be double or triple. Or what was your experience of that? Did you feel like it was you were always the center of attention in some of the places you were at?
I think for me, it was actually different. There was still a part of me that, even though I might have been part of the Marine Corps, I still felt like an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And my perception now, looking back, has always been different. It's how would I even explain that? There are certain mentalities that the Marine Corps builds, but at the same time, I still had compassion in my heart. I didn't join the Marine Corps because I wanted to kill people necessarily.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to train, but didn't necessarily focus on the killing part, even though we shot guns, went to the range all the time.
Right.
I knew how to do that. It was just another tool in the toolbox, but I wasn't that trigger happy Marine. I was more of a, how would I even explain that? It's just a perception that I'm trying to bring into words at this moment.
More of an intellectual Marine, more of a mental.
I can honestly say that part of me being exposed to the capacity of what I could do,
mm-hmm,
also brought me back into my heart space.
Yeah, right.
I will say that.
Mm.
Because there are moments where something could have went a certain way,
mm-hmm,
but I was able to meet that
Event
mm-hmm, in another way.
Yeah.
So going back, could you please ask me the question that you...
Yeah, just the idea of when you're in fatigues, right, you're in another country, you're carrying a weapon. Did you feel yourself at the center of attention in public spaces, for example?
No, not necessarily.
Yeah.
Because there were so many other people with me at the same time, so I don't feel like the direct eyes were directly on me, because
sure,
there were so many of us.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, what an amazing eye-opening place, especially for somebody 19. I mean...
Right, I actually deployed to Iraq when I was 23.
Oh, okay.
So, still young. But I had some time in the Marine Corps. I had at least like three and a half years before I actually deployed, which is pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. So how long did you spend overseas with?
With the Marine Corps, I spent 5 months.
Okay.
Overseas.
Yeah. Okay. And then when your tour was up, you were ready.
When my tour was up, I had broke my ankle in Iraq.
Okay.
Working out.
Okay.
And when I got back, they fixed my ankle, and they wanted to keep me in for like a medical discharge, but I got out of the Marine Corps on crutches, actually.
Mm.
But when it was time to get out of the Marine Corps, instead of reenlisting, I was happy to leave the Marine Corps due to how I felt about the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
In the Marine Corps, they say that the good guys get out, and the guys who... I mean, there's still good guys in the Marine Corps. I don't need to go into that quote.
Sure.
I don't think it's serving. So.
Yeah. I'm sure there's all different reasons why you might stay or why you might go, right?
Exactly.
And so leaving the Marine Corps, and that brought us back up to that private contract security time.
Right. So when I left the Marine Corps, actually I got out and my daughter was born on September 22nd. So right before I got out of the Marine Corps, and, I got out of the Marine Corps and I started doing construction, like labor ready and mm-hmm, stuff like that. At that time, I was drinking lots of alcohol. I actually messed up my back in the Marine Corps in boot camp, to where I separated, a disc came out of alignment, so I had a herniated disc in my back.
Mm-hmm.
My flexibility was not so good. And I was drinking copious amounts of alcohol due to the guys that I lost in Iraq.
Mm.
mm-hmm. and I was ungrounded and doing what I could to try to provide for my family.
Yeah. Were you living together, mother yes. and, yeah.
Mm-hmm. She was actually still in the Marine Corps okay. when I got out.
Okay.
So we lived on base and had base housing, which was a nice little.
Yeah.
Yes.
A good security blanket for sure. And so talk about the period between then and right. going into.
So I got out of the Marine Corps at the tail end of 2004. And I did not start my first contracting gig until 2008. So initially when I got out of the Marine Corps to work on these high threat security jobs, they wanted all special forces guys. Mm-hmm. So your Navy SEALs, they wanted you to have that experience because the mission was different at that time, at least. And when I finally got my security clearance and things as such, they had opened it up to guys who had some small team experiences and or guarding presidents. So doing mm-hmm. like security details. So when I did SWAT in the Marine Corps, we would do presidential details to where if another president would land from another country and talk to one of our generals or whatever else, mm-hmm. we do security details for the president that was landing to visit mm-hmm. our top generals. And then at the same time, I did security details for different generals within the Marine Corps in Okinawa. And when President Bush would land, we'd be a part of the security detail that would interact with Secret Service. So doing those things allowed me to have the experience
mm-hmm.
to show up or to go try out for these high threat security positions with the Department of State as a civilian.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that the security positions were kind of a transition based on it being challenging after you came back from Iraq to kind of reintegrate back into regular world.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by what was challenging?
So what was challenging for me is that I tried to find I attempted to do the construction trade, but at the same time doing the construction trade, we didn't have there wasn't the same camaraderie that you get when you are working with the guys that, let's just say in the Marine Corps, guys that served in other branches.
Sure.
And I found that I actually enjoyed having a more structured life around eating healthy and working out and training.
Right.
And my body was just equipped for it and I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in, at the same time, having the consistent paychecks just roll through, that's like freedom of mind.
Sure.
So after I finally got a wrap on my drinking and things as such and started getting back into shape, I probably prepped myself for like a year and a half. I had already applied for the companies, but there wasn't so many opens because the stacks of applicants were just piled up.
Yep.
And then when I finally got my shot at it, the transition, okay. Going back to the original question that you asked me, the transition. So after finding that I didn't have a good fit in the civilian life, mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to what it is that I knew how to do, that I had been trained how to do.
Yeah.
And the high threat security provide me with that outlet to go back to.
Right.
Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think okay. so. I mean, okay. I think that what I understand for a lot of veterans who have seen combat is that it's hard to come back and reintegrate into everyday society. Yeah.
Exactly. And going back over there, I knew what I was getting myself back into.
Sure.
It's like, you know, you have a couple
things.
The
devil you know, kind of.
Yeah, sometimes mm-hmm. you might get mortar fire. You might, on different missions, like, you knew exactly what you were going up against. Here, dealing with relationships and all of these other things.
Yeah.
It was stimulus coming from every direction over there. I feel like you kind of knew what was going on, so you knew what to expect.
Mm.
And therefore, like, it was a lot easier. At the time when my daughter was, I started contracting when my daughter was 4 or 5 years old, and her mom was still in the Marine Corps and kept on moving around. And I found out that I couldn't just move around and follow her mom everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So there, the opportunity opened up, and I found that it was easier for me to go back into that, because it was like being in the military, but being able to kind of put yourself where you wanted to go, depending on what openings they had wherever.
Right.
And honestly, contracting became a very healing experience for what I experienced in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Because as I was contracting, say like being in Somania, which is northern Iraq, just above Erbil, the mountains up there look like Colorado.
Mm.
And being exposed and being part of the security detail, taking these diplomats out and interacting with the people, instead of in the wartime situation, but in the reconstruction part, actually I found healing.
Yeah.
They weren't my enemies. They were just other people. And we'd sit around and eat food with them on different parties that the diplomats would attend and things as such. So it became a healing process of me going back over there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's that. I can imagine that it's so. And so, we met how long after 2013, because I remember you talking about, when we were first meeting each other, you were still involved, I think, or you just finished maybe.
I started practicing at Kindness Yoga in October of 2013.
Okay.
Carolina was my first yoga teacher.
Hmm.
And that's when I first started practicing at Kindness. But when I was in Pakistan, I was actually doing the P90X program. And I always skipped over the yoga because I was like, what do I need to do yoga for?
Right.
And I saw a video with Tony Horton saying, do the damn yoga. And then I realized, I could do anything. Like, my body had an athletic body. So
yeah.
Physical fitness was just second nature, I guess you could say. But when it came to the yoga was very challenging. I couldn't still my mind. I was all over the place. And I realized that my flexibility was just not so good.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that became challenging. I'm like, I want to get good at this.
Right.
And I was doing the P90X yoga, which was a 90-minute program. And then that was in 2009 or 2010, that was actually in 2009. And then when I came back to the States, I went to a yoga class, and there were beautiful women everywhere, and they're like, breathe deeply. And it just like, it was so much easier for me.
Hmm.
I was, P90X yoga was like really hard.
Right.
But when I came back into the yoga studio, they're like, meet your body where it's at. And I started finding different ways to engage with yoga, not just trying to do everything at once, but meeting your body where it was at. And that's how I first came into yoga.
Yeah.
And then I was on doing like Groupons and jumping around. And then I found Kindness Yoga through, I believe it was a Groupon.
Yeah.
In October of 2013.
Mm.
And that's where the journey, I've been practicing there since then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. October is one of my favorite months. Good job. And so how was it for you to be in a group class experience? Was there anything scary about that? Was based on military service and just being in groups, feeling exposed?
So I necessarily didn't feel exposed because, I don't know if you're going to get upset when I tell you this, I had a hip pack.
Mm-hmm.
With my, I had a concealed weapons permit, but I had my hip pack with my gun
so
in it,
with
my sidearm in it in my yoga class.
Yeah, no, great. I mean, great. Great is what I say today. I don't actually have a real strong opinion about it. Some part of me says, whatever it takes.
Right.
But I can hear in that there was a need.
Yes, it created ease for me to be in the class to fully let go because it only takes a couple of seconds for me to grab that firearm and
defend yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so what in your mind thinking to yourself, okay, I'm gonna bring my hip pack in the class.
Right.
Can you describe what was the fear of?
No, it wasn't the, it, actually there wasn't a fear. It was actually, I considered at that time and just up to recently, I considered a firearm like carrying a pen. Right. It's there if you need to sign something.
Yeah, sure.
So it wasn't, it was just having a tool in the toolbox. You don't always use your tools all the time, but
right.
having it there, if something arises, I'm the best person to have that at any moment
right.
to extinguish something that might happen.
And so do you feel like it, if that hadn't been an option to bring that into the room, how do you think it would have, would you just not have gone?
I wouldn't have went.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't have.
Yeah. And so do you feel like that's a sentiment that many people that come out of the military would have?
So to that sentiment, like earlier we were talking about how some veterans can't lay down on their back with their arms wide open and close mm-hmm. their eyes. But having another veteran sit up in front of the class and keep overwatch is what I would say. I'll keep overwatch.
Yep.
And if you feel comfortable, you can close your eyes and relax
mm-hmm.
and attempt to fall asleep if you can.
Yeah.
I'll be here and I'll keep watch out while you do
mm-hmm.
so.
Mm.
So I feel that if I would have someone saying those words
yes.
when I was practicing yoga and knowing that I can trust that guy because he's been through the same things that I have, that might allow me to relax in many other ways.
Yeah, right. Hmm. What a great perspective. And so you practiced yoga starting October 2013 with us.
Right.
And when did you, remind us when you did teacher training?
I did my teacher training in 2014, December 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Who were your trainers?
My trainers were Virginia Biddle, Jack Cuno, Lindsay Gonzalez, and Kristen Boyle was doing a little
in and out.
Mm-hmm. In and out, yes.
Cool. What was it like in terms of whether there was a moment that you remember where you were signing, but similar to the recruiter situation where you know you had committed yourself to a path, committing yourself to a teacher training, a very different path. Can you talk a little bit about mindset, heart set at that point?
So at the time that I decided to go to yoga teacher training, it's because I had been practicing yoga for some time and I wanted to become a yoga teacher to help the veterans in the way that yoga had helped me.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to facilitate classes to aid them in different pathways of healing. So that was my intention. So when I signed up for my yoga teacher training, I was so ready for it. Like I was ready to share mm-hmm. the gifts of yoga with others to help them move from the state of the military mindset into the heart space of what I felt, the ease.
Yeah. And is that the distinction, moving from head to heart, ease? Is that, how would you describe the experience?
I would find that moving from head to heart is you don't have these ideas moving around in your head. You have a little bit more peace. You have your breath. You have quietness. You have that piercing silence.
Mm.
So it's, that's what I consider moving into your heart.
Yeah.
I can hear it right now in the back.
Mm. Hmm. When you say you hear it, describe what you mean for people who might not.
It's the silence behind everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's that piercing, like,
I can hear it now that you describe it like that.
Exactly. When you soften your ears and you soften your senses, you can hear it all around you.
Yeah.
You can be in the most loudest spaces at times. And if you soften and open up your perception even wider, you can hear it all around at times too. So
mm-hmm.
it's a beautiful place to be able to tap into.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And, through teaching veterans yoga, I was able to help them reach these other places.
Mm-hmm.
And in those other places of finding that nothingness, just the beingness, is where the healing starts to happen. It's where your nervous system starts to settle and you get out of that fight or flight mode into that easeful mode. And that's where I feel that the healing starts to take place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk a little bit about the first veterans class that you taught.
So I partnered up with, I looked at veterans yoga in Denver to see if there were any veterans classes. And I found out that somebody held like a veterans yoga class at Red Rocks and her name was Sarah Plummer.
Uh-huh, I remember Sarah.
And I went and spoke with Sarah Plummer to see if she would start teaching the yoga classes, because the VFW Post 1 just got this brand new building in the Santa Fe Art District. And she agreed to teach the classes. And I just did all of kind of reaching out to different veterans and stuff like that to start bringing them into yoga. And she actually started teaching the classes mm-hmm. while I was going through yoga teacher training.
Mm-hmm.
And I first taught my yoga class after yoga teacher training. And how was that for me? I was very nervous because I had the self-limiting beliefs of what if I can't do this or whatever else. Me standing up in front of people is like, what do I have to show? What do I have to give? Or mm-hmm. whatever else. You know how all that stuff goes.
Yeah.
And I found that I was trying to teach to the script of what I was taught in yoga teacher training.
Uh-huh.
And then I, through times of being up in front of the class, I started to gradually spin things my way.
Uh-huh.
And as I started to spin things my way, I realized that I started getting more responses from the guys taking the classes, to where they would lay out on the floor and just like start falling asleep at times. Mm. And I felt that was good.
Yeah.
I still feel that it's good. And I encourage people to fall asleep, because when you can fall asleep, you're relaxed.
You're safe.
Exactly. So yes, that's how my first class was. And that's how it started to gradually attune to what I felt was right. So the way that I started to mold my classes with the veterans was I tried to bring everyday situations where yoga might need to come in, whether it's sitting in traffic or dealing with a loved one or bending over to tie your shoes or standing up at the sink washing the dishes. So I would bring like literally just mindfulness body activations within standing up and doing the dishes, drawing your belly button to spine, noticing where your breath is. And cue them through them imagining them doing the dishes. How are you standing with all four corners of your feet grounded into the ground, standing loose, just bringing awareness to all the moments that they could bring yoga into their daily lives.
Yeah.
And that's where I found like it really started to take place with the guys and the girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when you think about veterans today, what is the biggest challenge with somebody that's been in combat coming back home?
I find that the biggest challenge would be integration to the family life again, to society. At times, the military can be a template of how to wake up in the morning and do everything else, and finding that motivation to step into a new direction without a template, I find is the biggest challenge.
And do you see that yoga and mindfulness training, could that be a part of it as a more in a systematic way, like from the government side even?
100%.
Yeah.
It's when you start to soften your mind, you still the fluctuations in your mind and then tune into how your body is feeling. Your body is a GPS. It can guide you in the right direction. So attuning to our bodies mindfully can be like, oh, this doesn't feel good to me. Oh, this feels good to me. So not only can we show up with more awareness, but we can start to move towards the things that resonate within our bodies that create ease and a peaceful way of being.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So yes, that's a major tool. And seeing how from our first yoga class to how it is now, like when most veterans get out of the military, they go to do the CrossFit classes where they're playing the loud music. And it's just at same times, it's triggering all of the certain experiences that they have and they're living in that same moment. But when we come into the more mindfulness yoga aspect, yoga is just an idea.
Mm.
When we come into bringing more awareness and how it is that we're showing up in life and what we are doing, then that in tune just makes us put more intention into what we are doing with everything, whether it be work, interacting with our families, just showing up in the world, how we wake up in the morning. It's bringing awareness to everything. That's what yoga and mindfulness is.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that I can imagine high intensity environments,
yes,
like combat, take you really out. I mean, in a way, you're present in a way that you're not present. You're not encouraged to be present here,
right?
Because it's need based there, right? Survival based. Is that true? In certainly in combat situations, there would be a need to be present in a unique way.
Yeah, 100%. There's a need to be present in that way. That's why I think when you start moving into mindfulness, it actually, the two work hand in hand together in ways. Mm. And what I find that is moving from mindfulness, your nervous system has been opened up and you've been stimulated in these high ways. It's like once that opening happens, what do these gaps get filled with?
Right.
So I find that mindfulness helps you come back down to let the gaps fill back in, to bring yourself back into your mind and your body connection. And then from there, you can start to restructure your nervous system to kind of, I would say, bring your atmosphere down a little bit more back down to earth instead of having the bubble be so big from the expansion of what has happened due to the stimulus and combat.
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of like you get expanded out so far as a result of being in an atypical situation from day-to-day life here in the States, that you're so expanded that when you come back here, that expansion actually doesn't serve inside of this normalcy. It's almost like normalcy in that level of expansion is a threat.
Yes, 100%. And it's easier to get back to that expansion of where you once were when you don't kind of bring things back down.
Mm-hmm.
It's like another pathway that's just there.
Mm-hmm.
So in any situation where you might feel that body response of like wanting to punch someone in the face.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like being exposed to combat, you might take it a little bit too far.
Yeah.
Instead of just punching them once, you might totally start doing other things. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's...
misinterpret the threat. Misread the situation.
Exactly.
The intentions... The level of intensity that you might bring might be out of step.
Right.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's like, it's also letting go of this idea that you have to keep things fresh so you know how to react in a situation also. And what I mean by that is like, instead of having the weapon always closer to me, I started either leaving it in my car, or knowing that at any situation I started opening my awareness up in different ways. And where am I going with this? Talking about the bubble expanding and how to bring it back down into. So it's not necessarily letting go of the idea of the whole military life and holding on true to what you did, but we don't have to bring it up every single day. We can bring ourselves... I'm going somewhere with this and I'm kind of...
Well, one thing that I hear inside of it is that there's a need in the beginning when you came back to feel comfortable by having your weapon with you. And then at some point you start to...
Exactly. So it's like having a tool in the toolbox. You always carry your toolbox with you, but your mind isn't always focused on that.
Right.
Because like within your training, you practice so much.
Yes.
So you always know how to react in certain situations.
But those situations aren't here.
Exactly.
And so what I hear, and one of the reasons that, you know, I haven't become a gun owner myself. My stepfather's a gun owner, and I don't have a problem with gun ownership. But what I notice about it is that anytime there's a weapon in the space, that becomes my solution. That becomes my answer to the problem.
Exactly.
So if I have a gun and I think somebody's walking around my house, I don't leave the gun and then go check it out. I take the gun with me to check it out. And the gun now is part of whatever solving that I try and create in the situation.
Exactly.
And, you know, I think that my best sidearm is my mouth and my compassion and intellect and ability to humanize a situation. And so I've always felt that having a gun would actually put me at a disadvantage.
Exactly. That's beautifully articulated.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it has a lot to do with our gun culture and this idea of, you know, if I have a headache, I take an Advil.
Exactly.
I don't actually look at the behavior that led to me having a headache. If I feel vulnerable, I get a gun. I don't look at the situation in terms of, you know, from a systemic or from a personal system standpoint and say, if I'm not feeling safe, what are all the ways that I could explore feeling safe? And some of that might be going to therapy. Some of that might be, you know, working out on a regular basis and lowering my stress. I mean, you're across the board, right? Yes. There's a whole bunch of solutions.
Exactly.
But I can also go to Walmart and pick up a gun.
Right.
And problem solved. It's underneath, it's underneath my mattress. And totally. So I feel a lot safer now because if anybody bothers me, I'll shoot them. So, I can really get that I can project that military service teaches one to use the tool.
Right.
And you know, that's needed ostensibly in the situations where military service is being employed.
So in the Marine Corps, we don't necessarily resonate with being called a soldier. We consider ourselves warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason why I felt like I needed to carry a gun with me all the time is because I felt like I needed to protect. And part of me having that weapon, if anything shall arise, was a part of that warrior spirit.
Right.
For me to protect other people.
Mm.
And I found that I can still protect other people, but now I consider myself the warrior of love and light. And what I mean by the warrior of love and light is I can find new ways to communicate with others to where I don't need a weapon.
Yeah.
I can look someone in the eyes and have compassion and empathize of where they might have been due to all the things that I've been exposed to myself and the people that I've grown up with and interacted with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Aho. Yeah. Isn't it beautiful how warrior, it's a lot broader than one might think from playing, you know, video games or something like that, where warrior, you know, warrior two, you know, in warrior one, warrior three, we use and invoke the name warrior in our yoga practice. And it's always an interesting thing to think about that a yogi is a warrior that uses heart, breath, mindfulness to combat the stressors.
Yes.
And, you know, it's one of those interesting conversations that says we have a Department of Defense, you know, we could really use a Department of Peace.
We could.
And how would you arm the Department of Peace? I think that's a really fun administration point to take on for whomever holds the office in Washington. I want to ask you a couple of questions. So, what would you say to a veteran, knowing your path, knowing your experience, and the road that you've taken? What would you say to a veteran who's just returned from a high intensity situation back to civilian life? What would you say to them?
Depends on how we ended up in the conversation in the first place. So what would I say to them?
Yeah, if they're just listening right now. About coming back into civilian life.
For me and myself and my experience, what I would recommend is if they were finding themselves not being able to find a flow, that rolling your mat out and breathing and moving your body would be a great way to start to find the path that you might want to move into. Mm-hmm. And developing a practice of yoga or mindfulness, or even walking in the woods with no technology and just noticing the trees. Yoga doesn't necessarily have to be moving to a mat, but just developing some type of present moment awareness or mindfulness would help you a long ways if you don't already have that.
Yeah. And let's say that they were coming back to Denver. Where would one start that journey in your mind, or what would they even Google?
VFW Post One Yoga.
Uh-huh.
And here in Denver, and they have a bunch of different classes on the Comeback Yoga website.
Comeback Yoga.
Comebackyoga.org, I believe it is. So they So the yoga program that started at VFW Post 1 has expanded to joining forces with Ned and Margot Timble with Comeback Yoga. And now yoga can be found at all of the VA outpatient clinics and the VA hospital and all different types of places. But they have a list of different locations on the comebackyoga.org website.
Okay, great. We'll mention those in the show notes for folks that might be seeking those things. What would you say to a civilian who is interacting with a newly returned vet or a vet of any time back in the States? What would you want them to know about veterans that is kind of true as a, what would you want them to remember about veterans in general?
I can only speak for myself. So what comes up for me is for me and myself, I just want to be looked at as any other human being and seen for the light that I exude from my heart. And I think with other veterans, they want to be of service at the same time too. They want to feel like a part of some things. So what would I say to the civilian coming into contact with them? It's just to not have a disposition?
Preconceived
idea of what this person has gone through, because we all have different levels of trauma, whether it be a veteran or a civilian. But assuming that everyone's the same is, I would say, a no-go.
Yeah, veterans are just like anyone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, some veterans want to be put on a pedestal and everything else, but at the same time, like...
So does any other civilian.
Exactly. Sometimes. We all want to feel like we're something in the world, I guess you could say.
Well, one of the things that I think from my civilian perspective that you mentioned that really kind of just totally opened the context up for me is that a person who served in the military may want to be armed because their job is to protect. And I had just had it as a much smaller or personal context. Mm-hmm. I carry a gun so I feel safe if I'm a military person, versus I carry a gun because my job and what I've been trained for is to protect and care for United States citizens, let's say.
Exactly.
And so I just think that it really bears repeating that there is a training, very intense training under intense circumstances that goes into helping our military servicemen and women be at service. And that part of that service is around firearms and being ready to be in service in that way.
Right.
Yeah, that was a totally new perspective for me. Jarrell, the last question that I have for you today is talk about how kindness shows up in your life and just the anything that you want to say about how you utilize kindness as maybe part of who you are today and how you show up.
The first thing that comes to my mind about kindness is the way I show kindness is by showing up for myself first. And that can be in several different ways, whether it be finding my breath in a yoga class or waking up in the morning and finding peace. When I can find that connection to source or in presence, when I show up in the world, I can move through the world with a lot more ease and have a lot more patience when it comes to things. I find that patience is kindness, and just have more awareness within what is really going on around me. And that's equipping myself with the knowledge to notice different things rising up within other people and having kindness in my heart to know that that's not necessarily the person. I can start to see everyone else as another mirror or reflection of myself, and that noticing that through who might be standing in front of me that might be angry or upset is we're all breathing the same air. We are all in this together. And to me, kindness moves into everything, every aspect with myself and the people that I interact with. Kindness to me isn't one single word. It's something that integrates into everything. It's taking the time to look a person in the eye. I find that as kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Taking the time to let someone speak and holding space and not thinking of what to say next and breathing into my heart space. Kindness is awareness, I feel.
Yeah.
And that's how it shows up.
Yeah.
Being aware of our nervous systems, being aware of our thoughts, being aware of the food that we're consuming, being aware of everything. And then once we bring awareness to things, then we can start to notice what works for us. And when we start to follow that path to feel good, we're being kind to ourselves because we're honoring ourselves and where we're at. And that allows us to show up even better out in the world.
Yeah.
When we take care of ourselves first. That's kindness to me.
Yeah,
I answered it in a very abstract way. Hopefully that.
Oh man, and anything you say is totally worthwhile here. Thank you so much for your heart, for your evolution. Getting to watch you over these years and play a small part in how you've continued to grow into yourself has been really a pleasure and an honor. And it helps me see how an act of kindness on my part resonates out with another person. Oh, and yes. And then it continues, and to know that the effect that you've had on other veterans and just everybody that you come in contact with, I know is left just a little bit better, Jarrell. So thank you for today.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, everybody, really appreciate you tuning in today. Kindness Collective yoga studios are in Denver. We're donation based, and we'd love to support you in your path of mindfulness and evolution and just growing into who you are. So please come and check us out. Thanks.